Inside Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe, the podcast from UVB Online on the Tour de France. For 3 weeks, we accompany team manager Ralf Denk as he leads the biggest and most successful German cycling team through the Tour de France. Do you have questions for Ralf Denk? Send them to tobias.roof@vbmedia.de. And now, enjoy the new episode.
90% chance of a sprint. That is what team manager Ralf Denk said yesterday before the 12th stage, and that is exactly how it turned out. Four breakaway riders were kept on a very short leash for a long time. Perhaps even a bit too short, because 30 kilometers from the finish it got really hectic again, including a crash in the final 100 meters. In the end, Binyam Girmay takes his third victory at this year's Tour de France. We are taking a look at it together, and for that I welcome Ralf Denk here by my side. Hello Ralf, hello and good evening to Rosenheim. We are going straight to the most important thing from today, and that was this very heavy crash a few meters before the finish. The most important question, of course, from your perspective. I believe everyone got through it unscathed, right?
Yes, the crash was severe, but it happened in the second or third row at most. We were 100 meters from the finish, and our riders were already so far back due to the 3 kilometer rule that none of them were involved and everyone is fine.
Yes, it really looked quite severe. Fernando Gaviria slipped, taking another rider down with him. Abrahamsen crossed the finish line looking very battered. Two from Lotto Intermarché fell right over them.
Something like that. It doesn't leave you cold, even when you're already riding your 13th Tour de France, right? Yes, the crashes, especially in the sprint, are always violent, aren't they? And speeds here are reaching 70 kilometers per hour.
And so you can imagine it. You could try driving a car at 70 and falling out of the door. Right? It is about the same thing, and you would never do that. But you can imagine it, and that is quite a hard impact.
It usually ends well, mostly. The majority of riders who are involved in such crashes are at the starting line the next day.
Yes, they are tough. Nonetheless, not the kind of images you want to see, of course. And I must say, I think you recommended something similar last year. Please do not jump out of a car at 70 kilometers per hour. Don't do it. Just don't.
Maybe stick a hand out to get a feel for it. That's more than enough.
Not that we are encouraging anything here. Yes, until it got to that point, things were actually going the way we have seen many of the sprint stages go. Not too big a lead, always just about a minute. There was also some confusion at times as to why they were only kept at 40 seconds, because then attacks came again after all.
This little track tried a few things to avoid the sprint. In the end, there was a real chaos once again.
How did you experience that? Were the breakaway riders actually almost too close this time?
Yes, that certainly doesn't make it any easier when you have breakaways. You keep them, and that's the nasty part of professional cycling, often at a distance or on a short leash. And you close the gap today when you didn't even want to close it. But clearly, when a breakaway group like today is only 40 seconds ahead, they aren't going full throttle at the front either, because they know exactly that we have no chance. Only if that gap were to open up to 3 minutes, then they would ride at full speed in front. And because of that, they were reeled back in relatively quickly, but it still became relatively difficult again anyway. I did not commit 100% yesterday that there would be a bunch sprint, only 90%, because the topography in the last 30 kilometers really invited people to try something, to attack, to make the race difficult. And above all, Little Trek invested a lot there today. But in the end, it was also up to them. And they have a strong team here with a lot of manpower, meaning pace-setting riders. And even they didn't manage to open up a gap today. And that's why it finally came down to a bunch sprint. And then what we've seen so often happened again. Tim Merlier is unbeatable when it comes down to the very last meters.
Maybe a word more about him. He has now taken 3 wins. It probably doesn't get much better than that, especially when there aren't that many sprint finishes. The riders already said afterwards that they might still be hoping for Paris, but with the route change, that's likely very, very difficult, I dare say. I would say he made the absolute most of what was possible, right?
Absolutely. And he is definitely the strongest sprinter in this year's Tour de France. 3 stage wins already. What must also be noted, Jasper Philipsen, the protagonist of the mass sprints in recent years, had a textbook lead out today, but still failed to finish it off.
He is simply not at the level of recent years. That is my assessment. Yes, why is that? Probably only he himself could say. Sometimes just a few percent are missing to no longer be the best. Or how do you see it? Yes, that is of course hard for me to judge now.
I don't know how the preparation went, but I can only put the facts together. And normally it was always a head-to-head duel, Tim Merlier against Jasper Philipsen, but this year Tim Merlier is clearly the stronger one. Yes.
What we can also note is that you all got through it well again, perhaps also a small symbol. The mood does not seem to be bad. It made the rounds today. Florian Lipowitz tried to get rid of his bottle once, and there are always these targets where the fans like to have the cycling bottles. He threw it quite wide and then said that is why he did not become a beer athlete.
Things like that show he is in good spirits, and the mood is right, isn't it? Yes, the mood is right, because the guys also realize they are doing well, they feel good, and when it is a bit easier on the stage, then you can have a little fun like that. The spectators always set up targets for bottles, or some even set up nets like sort of a quiver, facing the wrong way, wanting to collect bottles or inviting them to collect bottles. And Florian did a spectator a favor, but I think he missed.
Yes, exactly. the bottle then landed somewhere in the ditch until the spectator finally fished it out of there.
And it's also nice that not every kilometer is being ridden completely seriously here, even though we are at the Tour de France. And today was probably the last flat stage, the last chance for the sprinters. From now on, we head first to the Vosges, then to the Jura, then to the Alps. And there are many mountains coming where things will get very, very serious.
Yes, the fun gets dialed back a bit and the watts probably go up. Thank you very much, Ralf. I would like to talk to you about a background topic that Jonas Vingegaard hinted at a little bit. In an interview a few days ago, he mentioned that he even thought about retiring towards the end of last year. He spoke about the many challenges he faces as a professional cyclist, constant weight checks, being away from his family, always having to perform, and a tough race calendar. And he then said, "I said last year, if things keep going like this, then count me out." Can you put that into perspective? To what extent can you understand this statement from Jonas Vingegaard? Yes, I find it difficult to talk about the details at Visma Lisa Bike and Jonas Vingegaard because I am not involved in that team. I manage our team.
But I think I can summarize it in general terms, especially the general classification riders, those who are fighting for top 10, top 5, top 3, or victory in the big tours like the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France, or the Vuelta a España. They naturally race beforehand. You need that race toughness. That means for those who, for example, want to perform very, very well at the Giro d'Italia in May, those who have podium ambitions, they are already racing from January. And besides, if you really want to have a chance, if you are a protagonist in a Grand Tour, you have to prepare with at least 2 altitude training camps. That means there are many days of abstinence due to the tours, due to the races you ride as a cyclist. That is 70 race days. That means with travel days, that is already 100 to 120 days you are away. Without all the altitude training camps, you simply need to be competitive. And all these altitude training camps I am now at my 13th Tour de France did not exist in this concentrated amount, in this volume back then. I can still remember when we arrived here for the first Tour de France, only two riders had trained at altitude 2 weeks before. Today, you train at altitude for 3 weeks and at least twice, maybe even three times before a major tour. And I think that is what became a bit too much for Jonas, where he then raised his hand and said, besides the 70 race days that I do, plus, yes, another 100 days or at least 100 days of training camps on top of that. And at some point, I'm just not home at all. And there are just guys, especially those with families who are very attached to their homes. And for them, it is naturally a bit harder than for people who perhaps are not yet tied down by family and those who are still more at the beginning of their careers.
Every cyclist is different. For Jonas, it became too much. He raised his hand. The team made some adjustments, I believe, to his race schedule, his training camp schedule. And, well, now he is sitting here in second place. Apparently, the collaboration between the team and Jonas worked out quite well in that case.
I also said himself that he is much happier again than he was a year ago. You just touched on it a bit, but I'd still be interested in how you handle that and to what extent you can accommodate the riders, because you just said race days are set, the riders have to be there, stage races take even longer, of course, altitude training camps are unavoidable these days. Doesn't really leave much room to tell the riders, hey, you can stay with your family a bit longer here or there. How do you handle things like that? Are there individual arrangements or do the riders just have to, well, just put up with it?
No, we have to prevent things like that, kept the team organized training comps as small as possible. And by small, I mean in terms of volume. And we have already recommended to the riders, and you have to go to altitude on your own, and we will offer little to no support there. But that is a great opportunity. Take your wife, your girlfriend, or your kids with you and go to Tenerife or Livigno or somewhere else for 3 weeks and use the time to train. Livigno, for example, is super well suited for that because it has a nice town center. There is plenty to do. You can go shopping and so on. So it is not as dreary as the winter altitude training camps, for example, in Tenerife. And say you can perhaps even combine family life with children to some extent with training. And the racers really appreciate this freedom that they don't just have to stay within the team environment, but that they have certain freedoms to shape their training camps more individually.
I see. So what are the absolute mandatory dates that you offer? Because you say there are fewer, but surely there are things where there is no alternative, because primarily one can always discuss with us, is this training camp useful for me or not? So the racer does have a certain say in that.
What is actually always set is the December training camp. That is usually 2 weeks in Mallorca. We want to have the whole team together here because this is also the platform where we create a lot of content for the season or what we roll out during the season. So here it is not just training in December, but content is also created for all the team's partners, and the racers really have to or should be on site there.
And for everything else, because racing is so tough, we always try to find individual solutions. I see. Perhaps the last point on this, which is also brought up again and again, is weight control, data, performance. They look exactly at how many calories are burned and how much can actually be eaten again. Sometimes you are hungrier than what you get, and sometimes it is exactly the other way around. Can you say that that you monitor the riders all year round, let's call it that, and do they ever get a break and are allowed to say, hey, I'm going to eat whatever I want for a month? Ultimately, they can always do that, but they pay the price. The price is that I'll get dropped. No, but all joking aside.
it is both a blessing and a curse for us in cycling that we are actually one of the few endurance sports, or actually the exception in endurance sports, where we can really record the actual power that the racer produces in races and in training. You cannot really do that with a marathon runner or a cross-country skier. You know which heart rate zones they were in during the race or competition, but you do not know the watts or the calories burned. We can only track that here in cycling. On one hand, that is very helpful for managing training and nutrition. But on the other hand, we can easily calculate you burned X calories today, you have Y calories as your basal metabolic rate, and exactly that goes on your plate. That is much more difficult in other sports like, say, marathon running or cross-country skiing to calculate as precisely as in cycling. And yes, our goal is, of course, to have a very linear weight curve. That means the cyclist goes, let's take a case study, into the Tour de France at 63 kilos, and ideally should come out at 63. He should not come out heavier, but he should not come out lighter either. And that is actually the art of the nutritionist on site, to put together an exact amount of food for every racer so that their weight does not increase, but also does not decrease. And yes, it is also no secret that simply lighter riders can ride up a mountain faster than heavier ones. And that is why you go to the limit with weight. But you must, of course, also know your limit, work out your limit, because too light also means loss of strength, susceptibility to infections and so on. So it is a fine line that you are walking, but as a top team, we naturally have experts for every area, and that is the approach. I do not see any massive loosening or anything like that, because if the plan is not strict, then I come back to what I said at the very beginning. The racer then pays the price, right? Also, and he wants to, the racer wants to as well. And when you get into the final week of the Tour de France in the Alps, no racer wants to ride around with 2 kilos more than they had at the start of the Tour de France, because that certainly won't lead to success.
Definitely, but is it also before and after that you say you set the guidelines, because you see in training how many watts they are pushing and then give some kind of recommendation so that they arrive in the right shape before heading into joint training camps, or is it strictly just for the Tour?
No, that is the case for every bike race, and I really emphasize recommendations, because if you have to force someone, it won't work anyway. We provide recommendations and we try to find characters who follow the recommendations on their own. It is to make our system so attractive that they want to follow it. Because if you just apply pressure from the top saying you must, that doesn't work anyway. Instead, we have to offer a system that makes the riders better and that the riders are happy to accept and implement. And we have asked for that in every respect, to make the package as attractive as possible, so that the racers then also sign with us, so that they then know, okay, with us they will get better. All right. Thank you very much for the background information. As always, an exciting insight. Now let us take a look at tomorrow.
It won't be quite as much fun as it seemed at times today. We touched on it briefly before. The flatter stages are over. It starts off relatively flat, but it lasts over 200 kilometers tomorrow with a Category 1 climb towards the end.
It looks more like one for the breakaway, especially since there is a decent descent after the climb. Would you agree with me there? Yes, it is possible that tomorrow will be a race for the breakaway. It could also be that two races take place within one race tomorrow.
Maybe a group will form on the long approach to the first climb, which is about 160 or 150 kilometers, but the riders must be good climbers because they still have to go up over the Grand Ballon Alsace, that is this Category 1 climb. So if you can't climb at all tomorrow, but you're in the breakaway, you have no chance of a stage win anyway. So it has to be riders who can climb, who will attack at the start tomorrow. And maybe they'll even get a 10 or 12 minute lead, or maybe just 5. We'll see. And then it could very well be that a second race for the yellow jersey for the general classification develops further back. I would give the breakaway a good chance tomorrow to make it to the finish. But I also expect a race for the general classification, especially on that first category climb. Does that mean for you just cruising along for the 160 kilometers to have the strength to stay with the group on the climb? Yes, but we also have riders in our ranks who might be able to win something like that from a breakaway group. As I said, we have to have the talks now about who will feel ready or who would be motivated to try something. And then we will forge a plan together for tomorrow. But priority one is, of course, that Remco and Florian climb with the best tomorrow. Then we will see who raises their hand tomorrow and maybe risks something.
For today, thank you very much, Ralf Denk. You are very welcome and best regards to Rosenheim.
That was the latest edition of Inside Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, the podcast from OVB Online on the Tour de France. You can find the podcast on all common podcatchers and on the websites of OVB Media and ePen Media. Thanks for listening and see you in the next episode.